305-5735 y hace una pequeña donación de 25 o más dólares. Acá en el cuarto de teléfonos hay un grupo de personas que están esperando tu llamada. Quieren platicar contigo, quieren escuchar tu voz. Quieren saber cuánto es la donación que vas a hacer hoy, 25, 50, 100, $5 a la semana, $10 a la semana, perdón, $5 al mes, $10 al mes, $20 al mes, de acuerdo a tus posibilidades, sin olvidar jamás de que este dinero, esta donación que tú haces, la puedes descontar en tu declaración de impuestos a fin de año. ¿Qué mejor manera de invertir tu dinero? 818-985-5735 es el número a llamar. 818-985-5735. El resto del programa del Informativo Pacífica de hoy, como los otros previos en los últimos 90 días, lo podrás escuchar visitando el sitio digital www.kpfk.org. www.kpfk.org. Ya que entres al lugar, buscas la sección de archivos de audio, programas, ahí está el Informativo Pacífica, la fecha de hoy, 29 de junio de 2016, ahí estará el programa en su totalidad, el programa entero de hoy. En tanto, en los 5 minutos y fragmento que tenemos ahorita, antes de que tengamos que abandonar el estudio para que pasen los compañeros y compañeras de Contragolpe, esperamos poder persuadirte, convencerte de que es importante tener un medio de comunicación alternativo, no porque pretendamos de que sea el único lugar donde tú puedes escuchar las noticias, no, para nada. Confiamos, sabemos perfectamente bien que una persona de tu nivel intelectual, de tu inteligencia, de tu sabiduría, de tu conocimiento de las cosas, por supuesto que tú vas a comparar los datos que escuchas en el Informativo Pacífica con los que ponen los medios corporativos, en la televisión, en la radio, en los diarios, en las revistas, y sacar tus propias conclusiones. Perfectamente, nosotros estamos de acuerdo, pero esta información alternativa, estos ángulos, estas voces, estos puntos de vista, estas ideas que salen acá en el Informativo Pacífica, yo estoy convencido de que no sale en ninguna otra parte, en ningún medio de comunicación en el sur de California, en esa cantidad y con esa claridad. Así pues, ese es el servicio que nosotros te damos, que nos comprometemos a continuar dándote. Y solo te pedimos que nos ayudes con que pongas tu granito de arena, que nos ayudes a financiar nuestras operaciones, la luz, el gas, el agua, las cosas que son necesarias para que una emisora de radio como esta pueda seguir operando como lo ha venido haciendo desde 1959. Y nuestra ambición, no tenemos que improvisar, no tenemos que averiguar a dónde queremos ir, no, nuestra misión es clara, nuestra dirección, nuestra ruta, nuestra meta está bien definida. Nosotros queremos seguir cumpliendo con la misión de Pacífica, es decir, prestar los micrófonos, el transmisor de radio, al talento de la comunidad, a los músicos, los poetas, los actores, los escritores, toda la gente que no tiene, que tiene esas cualidades, esas virtudes que le cierran las puertas a los otros medios de comunicación, que se vengan acá, porque aquí está una radio pacífica dispuesta a ponerlos en el aire. Esa es una función primaria de la misión de Pacífica. La otra es, a través de la programación, explorar, buscar e investigar las causas, las raíces de los conflictos y las guerras, con el propósito, bastante optimista la idea, pues, pero aquí estamos, ¿no? De que podamos generar un gran debate, una gran discusión ciudadana, para que se puedan legislar leyes que acaben con la guerra y que esos recursos destinados al militarismo, a la destrucción de otros semejantes, de otras ciudades, puedan ser utilizados en la construcción de cosas más nobles, más positivas. Por ejemplo, escuelas, bibliotecas, cosas que son sumamente necesarias, esenciales para el desarrollo humano, en lugar de la destrucción. 818-985-5735 es el número de llamar. Escasos 3 minutos que nos quedan, suficientes para que muchos de ustedes en el sur de California, desde Santa Bárbara, desde Ventura, desde el Condado de la Naranja, desde San Diego, Riverside, San Bernardino, desde todas las partes partes, cinco vecinas a la ciudad de Los Ángeles, desde donde nos escuchan, que puedan llamarnos al 818-985-5735 y hacer una pequeña donación. No tienes que tener la plata, la feria, la guita en la mano ahorita. También puedes hacerlo utilizando tu tarjeta de crédito o decirle a la persona que contesta el teléfono que te envíen la cuenta por correo. Cuando llegue el sobre, tú mandas tu cheque money order. También así se vale, ¿no? Puedes hacer una serie de pagos de $5 al mes, por ejemplo, que lo saquen de tu cuenta bancaria, que lo saquen de tu tarjeta de crédito, tu tarjeta de débito. En fin, hay muchas facilidades, hay muchas formas de hacerlo. Lo importante es que en este momento tomes ese teléfono, que marques el número 818-985-5735 y nos ayudes a mantener este medio independiente en el aire, porque sabemos de que en la medida que pasa el tiempo, en la medida que se afianza y se sumerge en su caos, en su torbellino destructivo, el neoliberalismo, el capitalismo avanzado como lo conocemos, en esa medida los medios de comunicación están quedando en más pocas y pocas manos. Menos de una docena de personas, de empresas, controlan la radio, la televisión, el cine, distribución de libros, distribución de videos, distribución de películas, todo. Nosotros somos una isla, una voz en el desierto, como diría el Juan Manuel Bautista. Aquí estamos con mucha gana, con mucha fe, tratando de hacer la diferencia, tratando de ser un faro que está ahí en la playa para que toda la gente que se mueve, que navega por el océano de la vida, pueda mirar un rayito de luz ahí que se oriente. 818-985-5735. Se nos acaba el tiempo. Los compañeros de Contragolpe ya están a punto de entrar. Queremos agradecer a Federico García por su buen trabajo en la cabina de controles, a las personas que están contestando los teléfonos, a las personas que nos llamaron. Muchísimas gracias de todo corazón por sus contribuciones. Y para las que lo están pensando, pues ya no lo piensen más, ¿no? 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. A nombre de Tostli, Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Si no le cambias al radio, siguen los compañeros de Contragolpe. Hasta luego.
Este verano se realizarán las elecciones para cubrir la mitad de los puestos de la Junta de KPFK de entre las personas nominadas de Radio Escuchas miembros y personal de la misma. Esperamos que ustedes consideren nominarse y asegurarse así de que se cumplan las necesidades de la estación y de la comunidad. Las nominaciones se aceptarán únicamente del 1 al 30 de junio. Para postularse o votar en las próximas elecciones, se deben hacer miembros de KPFK a más tardar este 30 de junio. Los radioescuchas pueden hacerlo mediante una donación de $25 realizada del 1 de julio del 2015 al 30 de junio del presente año. Otra opción es que sean un voluntario de la estación y donen 3 horas de su tiempo, o pueden solicitar una excepción debido a una dificultad personal. Para ver el calendario o bajar el paquete para las nominaciones, visite elections.pacifica.org. Para Pacífica, su voz y su voto son muy importantes. Recuerden que para participar en las elecciones deben ser miembros a más tardar el 30 de junio.
Te invitamos a escuchar Caminando por Nuestra América, un programa de entrevistas, análisis, crítica y autocrítica. Somos micrófonos abiertos a las voces de nuestras comunidades en la lucha por sus derechos y la preservación de su soberanía. Escúchanos todos los lunes de 11:30 p.m. a 12 a.m. Caminando por Nuestra América, espacio con identidad, solo aquí en tu radio KPFK. Acompáñanos.
Escuche Nuestra Voz, programa de información, análisis y cultura, donde su voz es la que cuenta. Todos los jueves a las 9:30 a 11 p.m. aquí, en KPFK 90.7 FM Los Ángeles. Nuestra Voz es parte de APE, Asociación de Programadores y Programadoras en Español de KPFK. Y recuerde, les esperamos todos los jueves a las 9:30 de la noche.
This is Captain Fred saying, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Paul, it's an honor to speak with you today. Tell me a little about yourself and your interest in the issue of homelessness. How did you get involved?
Basically, through a process of ending up kind of bouncing around from place to place. This was the late 70s, early 80s. We didn't have the tag homelessness yet. We didn't have a homeless problem yet. We just had more and more of us that were finding themselves with nowhere to live on a permanent basis. And living off of sisters, living off of friends, squatting. Went to Europe through a woman I met. Ended up hanging out at squats in Amsterdam and Copenhagen. Came back to New York. There was all the Avenue A, B, C stuff going on with the squats down there. And decided to come out to San Francisco. And through the good graces of one of my sisters, was able to get out here. And got involved with Hospitality House in January of 83. San Francisco started its homeless program in October of 82. And have been doing this stuff every day since then.
So looking back over the last 50 to 75 years, we have seen a huge shift in the number and visibility of homeless people in this country. Walk me through what happened and how we got to where we are today.
Well, when you actually go back and look at it from a cause and effect systemic perspective, instead of looking at, well, what drugs were available or deinstitutionalization or like, but something clearly happened shortly before October of 82, because New York City started opening shelters in 81, and police stations, empty police stations, were the first shelters in New York City. Here in San Francisco, it was empty muni buses that they put out in front of St. Anthony's and in front of the old welfare department. And it, everything was temporary, short-term, crisis, you know. But yet no one really seemed to stop and look and say, what's creating it? And when we did that, when I was even still at the coalition, so maybe 15, 17 years ago, we, working off of a report that Cushing Dolbrer, when she was still running the National Low Income Housing Coalition, had done, where we didn't ever really bunch of GED from the street dudes. I'll speak for myself. I didn't understand it. And the data that was flowing out of D.C. was a little bit over our heads. And it was like we couldn't use it if we couldn't understand it. It didn't really serve as an organizing tool for us until we pulled out public housing, Section 8, the programs that we knew that we all hung out with, and looked at those funding trends and looked at those charts and then started digging deep into exactly when the cuts came, who was the president at the time, what was appropriated versus what was allocated or whatever. And it showed so clearly that from 1979 to 1983, in 2004 constant dollars, $54 billion a year in affordable housing funding was cut by the federal government. So when you have this cumulative series of cuts that equals $54 billion a year, that then expands it and carries out at $54 billion a year over the next 25, 30 years, you ain't going to do nothing but create homelessness for people that are poor. And so that became a strong organizing tool for rap, especially because we're in all these different cities. So what are the common threads that we all have that connect us as one? And federal funding for affordable housing should be a connecting issue for every poverty-based organization, every social justice-based organization. And I say social justice because over that same period of time, the homeowner mortgage interest deduction program tripled. So it wasn't.
And you've been listening to an interview a couple years ago with RAP activist, Western Regional Advocacy Project activist, Paul Bowden, who is also the head of the Coalition on Homelessness for many years. You can find that just by Googling for Paul Bowden interview with Mike Rhodes, who is the Fresno activist who interviewed him, and a lot of other interviews with Bowden, too, are online. Coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, you'll be hearing the twice weekly Bathrobs Pier's Broadsides show, and it's a call-in show. It's at 427-3772 if you want to call in. So stay tuned and pick up your phone.
Confidence in terms of what these
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. A song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. It must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
Whoa, that's pretty, goes pretty fast, that song. Welcome, though, to another edition of Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. I'm Robert Norse, the bathrobed guy with the broadside. And this is, and has been for the last few weeks, a call-in talk show. We're on, of course, Pirate Radio at 101.3 FM, and we're streaming at freakradio.org. In the past, I put out biweekly, or actually twice weekly, notices mentioning what's on the show and encouraging people to tune in. I'm not doing that anymore because, frankly, I'm not quite sure what's going to be on the show. I kind of play it by ear as I come into the studio. Prior shows for the last, oh gosh, 8 or 9 months have been cooked up at home and then loaded onto the studio computer distantly. And so I actually knew what I was playing before the showtime, and I could let people know, kind of, at least give them a taste of what they could expect. I may try to do that in the future by having a sense of what it is I'm likely to be doing in the studio, but a lot of it is spontaneous, and really depends on who calls in and, frankly, what my mood is at the moment, what newspaper articles seem the most pertinent, what's breaking news and so forth. And also stuff from the past that I suddenly want to dredge up that seems relevant to me one way or another, and I don't generally anticipate that. So I hope you continue to listen to this show if you find it relevant. I hope you continue even more to call in and give me your experiences and your thoughts, your comments. And I also hope you act on some of the things that concern me. I mean, I've been a long time advocate of changing lots of the city's restrictive laws and policies regarding poor and homeless people, such as laws that criminalize being in the parks after dark or sleeping after 11 o'clock at night, both of which are crimes, and they're serious crimes. You can't immediately get jailed for them, but very soon, if you repeat them, you can. And for folks outside, they often repeat them ad infinitum. Now, it's also true that you can talk to someone, as I have, like Dreamcatcher, with a handful of tickets, and he just goes on without getting warrants. And that's because the courts have found it futile and costly, I guess. I'm guessing. I haven't really talked to the head of the courts about this or anything. Might be a good interview to have. To actually go after folks, drag them into custody, book them overnight, put them in court, have them face a judge and hear them say to the judge, I've got no money, and we'll get this usual cosmetic bullshit, which doesn't so much come from the judge. The judge is kind of required, or feels he's required. He actually has a lot of power to ignore these requirements, but often chooses not to. Feels he's required to give a sentence to this person, and you can get jailed for failing to appear for a court summons, which, even though the court summonses are preposterous and really a violation of the basic constitutional rights of people who have to be able to sleep at night, who have to be able to sleep somewhere at night. And if they're poor, they sleep where they have to. They sleep where they can. In Santa Cruz, that's 1,000 to 2,000 folks every night. In fact, that's the reason for the upcoming year anniversary, the Freedom Sleepers, the reason they're out there every night on a weekly protest, and the reason that Salinas's Flagpole Sleepers, and I'm not quite sure I have their name right, but they're doing something even more intense than the folks in Santa Cruz, and that they're there in Salinas every night sleeping, is to draw public attention to the criminalization of poor people in their town, specifically the criminalization of the act of sleeping, but a lot of other things too. I mean, when human beings are treated like second-class citizens, it's a serious matter. It's a kind of a fascistic situation where an underclass becomes the whipping boy and the underclass becomes also the threat. You may fall into the whipping class if you don't. The underclass that gets whipped, I guess it is the whipping class, or the whipped class, if you don't work harder and you don't continue to cooperate with the authorities, even if it's becoming increasingly difficult, if not impossible and exhausting to do that. So there is a year, well, I guess it's a year's worth of activist anniversary coming up in front of City Hall next Tuesday. That'll be on Tuesday, July 5th. The plans I've heard have to do with a video presentation, perhaps shown on the wall of the city's buildings. Actually, they might actually have some use for once, other than simply generating a staff that is busy working away enforcing laws that hurt poor people. And, you know, don't do so well for middle-class people either. I suppose it's unfair to more broadly characterize what other laws that are being enforced or not enforced, created or not created. But in any case, this anniversary is also intended to feature a memorial for homeless people who've died since last year, a year ago. Although I'm not sure that the Freedom Sleepers have been able to find all those names. They involve a sort of a cooperation from the coroner. I'm not sure if he is being cooperative. But there is, of course, a memorial every year at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, where people gather, put flowers in the water, make small speeches, remembering people who've died that year. A list of those folks is laid out, and then there are flags with the names of people from the last 20 years who have died. I was able to get that list from Matt Nathanson, and thank you, Matt, of the Homeless Persons Health Project. I'm not sure quite what the Freedom Sleepers are going to do with it. They might do something. There's going to be a march. There's going to be a meal. There's going to be an opportunity to remember folks who have come and gone in the last year. A lot of that, I think, has to do with homeless status and homeless situations and how homeless people are treated in facilities like the hospitals, how they're denied the right to not just to shelter, but to shelter themselves. When they do get into these wretched shelters, they're treated in a condescending and dehumanizing way, whether it's churches or a paid government shelter. It's generally pretty bad, and people try to avoid those situations. Some people can deal with it, and they find it better than being out in the rain and the cold, and I understand that. And indeed, I fought for the right to go into those shelters and the expansion of spaces for those who need to, but obviously, and choose to, but obviously that has nothing to do with real solutions to the right to shelter, the right to housing, the right to provide one's own shelter if necessary. And those are sort of the standard stuff that I am concerned about, and in its particular manifestations in Santa Cruz. So, for instance, I got a call today from a Food Not Bombs activist that she was at the courts, and she noticed that they were removing the grassy area that is directly in front of the courthouse. I don't mean the lawns that are adjacent to the pathways, but the grassy area that is on the sort of roundabout area where you drive to the courthouse, leave people off, and then go park your car, if you're familiar with that. It's kind of hard to describe if you don't know what I'm talking about. But there is a relatively large piece of area where people, some people, have rested and relaxed. And that area is, according to what this activist told me, about to be torn out. Similar to what's happening at the Santa Cruz City Hall, where they're tearing out, have torn out all the grass and have put in cement, I don't want to say artworks, walkways, I guess, paving over the area where people used to relax during the day and even at night until they started passing their can't be there at night laws that had nothing to do with the crime rate. It only had to do with the fact they didn't want those damn homeless people around. And it's just, it's a crime that judges who previously had seen this, at least seen in the most abstract sense, the idea of closing City Hall at night because the staff there don't like protests, or the mayor didn't like the protests that were going on, even though the mayor isn't there at night and the staff aren't there at night. They're embarrassed by them. They refuse to keep the restrooms there open at night, which might provide a benefit of an obvious kind, both to those who are protesting and the community generally. We have no 24-hour bathrooms. We only have one porta-potty at the corner of Front and Laurel Streets now. In this kind of situation where you have a really discriminatory situation, which it seems pretty clear that what's going on here is that different kinds of efforts are being mobilized to drive away poor people, to make it as unwelcome and inhospitable as possible. And I'm not going to belabor it. It's true. That's just sort of a bit of, I'm sure most people are aware of this. They sort of say, oh, isn't it a shame, and move on. I do too. I mean, I say more than it's a shame. I spend a few minutes denouncing it on the air on different programs and trying to catch police officers who are harassing people around it on audio so that we can hear this and maybe be shocked enough to do something. There was a radio show last night on KZSC, free radio broadcaster John Malkin, who also does a weekly show or an occasional show on KZSC up there, the campus station, had on two city council candidates, Steve Schnarr and Steve Plaich. And I think you may be able to find those archives. I'm not sure. John has tried to send me the archives, or not the archives, his recording of them. I'm not sure where he got it from. And I may play some selections on Sunday or at some point. But even city council candidates who express sympathy for and real concern about a number of the issues that impact poor and homeless people, not to the extent that I often demand of them or seek to press them to do, because I think they their voices in this community carry a certain authority, particularly Steve Plaich, who has... I'm not going to say, actually, I was going to say, inveigled his way onto different boards of directors. But, you know, he's the vice chair of the ACLU. I think he chairs the MHCAN. He was on SCORE at their board of directors, one board of directors after another. And he's also been a part of the Freedom Sleepers. Though, like myself, he no longer spends the night there. There's a small number of really devoted people, most of them homeless, who spend nights once a week outside City Hall. And my reason for not being there has been partially medical and partially exhaustion and the feeling that though I'm supportive of the Freedom Sleepers and though I want to help and do help, I believe, or at least I think it's helpful, to turn out weekly accounts of what's coming up and let people know what's going on at City Council the same day on those afternoons when the Freedom Sleeper are doing their Tuesday. Actually, every Tuesday they're there, so when the City Council is there. And by the way, they'll be gone throughout July. I'm... It's hard to put my heart into... the freedom sleepouts at City Hall once a week that are happening. And I try to exert some time and presence there. And I do encourage other people to do that, too, to the extent that they feel they can and they want to. And I will be continuing to do it as long as the Freedom Sleepers are doing it. But City Hall is kind of out of the way. It does provide a place for not just there being a protest, which gives heart to a lot of people, particularly, homeless people, I think it gives heart to. There are at least 20 or 25 or 30 homeless people who sleep there every Tuesday night. And that is a safe place for them in the sense that it's no more legal than anywhere else or any other night after 11 o'clock when it becomes illegal to sleep. But it seems to be a place where the police do not ticket them. They will get hassled. I think they had a big truck coming around in the morning. I don't know if it was washing the sidewalk or engaging in some other very noisy activity for the first time in a number of weeks. And there have been a number of other devices that could have been postponed, could have been otherwise scheduled, that seemed designed to either ignore or actively aggress against and discourage the Freedom Sleepers there. Freedom Sleepers have stood up to that or laid down to that and said, no thanks, we're going to still be here. And they will be here. They'll be here next week, and we'll be having this 50th anniversary celebration. I encourage people to come on down and join us. I know some folks from Seaside are going to be coming down, and we may be hearing from them on Free Radio. That's Wes White. You've heard him on the air before. He is sort of the one of the leaders of the protest that happens every night. I don't mean Seaside. I mean Salinas. Sorry, folks. That's happening in front of Salinas City Hall. And that's ongoing, nightly, although it has to be said it's legal at night in Salinas to sleep. It's legal to put up a tent, whereas in Santa Cruz, it's not. That's weird. It's not that Salinas is an enlightened city. No, they go after homeless people during the day, the notion being, as it is here in Santa Cruz, that visible poverty is deters business, or the more recent mythology and the more fascistic and dangerous one is that homeless people are somehow a threat. And then the liberal follow-up to this is, oh, we have to help them off the streets. And the reason they're there is because they don't know how to live in houses. Their addictions stop them from being able to have adequate housing, when in fact, of course, it's really hard for people with money to have adequate housing. The resources are all being generated towards the top, or many of them are. There's this increasing disparity that's happening, which is the reason for the huge turnouts for Sanders and Trump that have been happening. And if we don't get, as some have said, a real movement for genuine equality going, you're going to have a fascist movement that will be successful, because people are in trouble and they're angry that they're in trouble, and they're properly angry that they're in trouble. But I've got other stuff, and I'm going to turn to that rather than ranting on. For those who've been checking out the Chronicle, there's been a series for the last 4 days called Beyond Homelessness. And I have not looked at it closely, but the little I have, and you can find it online, San Francisco Chronicle Beyond Homelessness, or you can pay $1.50 per Chronicle if you'd like, $3 for the Sunday Chronicle. And it talks about, well, it's part of the liberal mythology that I began to talk about but didn't quite finish. The liberal notion is somehow that there's, the reason you have all these homeless folks is because there's just, you know, they're just not able to make it. They're all disabled and they're all in trouble with addictions and alcoholism and mental illness and maybe bad life choices. That's the more conservative perspective. And therefore, what's really needed are a lot of social service workers and supportive services. You can't just provide housing and income or housing and jobs. That doesn't work, you see, because these people are incompetent to do that. And that, I think, is just simply a big lie. There's a whole different issue as to whether people should be working the kind of shit jobs that many people have to work in order to pay the exorbitant rents that they're forced to do. That's an important issue, too. And that's one of the reasons some people are outside the so-called homeless by choice. But I don't think it's the reason most homeless people are outside. Again, I don't have stats for that. I don't have figures. Let's begin, though, with, because I want to catch up with stuff that I've failed to catch up with in the past. The Santa Cruz Board of Supervisors has come up with a sort of a proposed set of ordinances regarding cannabis cultivation. And I've done some past shows on this. Current cannabis cultivation laws in the county have to do with 99 plants and some setbacks from residences and schools and sort of limits on some areas. But there's no large bans, except that you have to have smaller growths. And in fact, the war on marijuana continues. If you look at today's Sentinel, you see the sheriff, I don't know if he's bragging or simply reporting, that is, his thugs moved in and removed lots of plants because they were beyond the 99-plant level. You know, imagine them going after corn for that reason or something. I mean, it's ridiculous. And it's an example of the kind of bigotry against a particular crop that makes it a special target. It's a make-work situation for police, lawyers, prison guards, prison employees of all kinds, drug recovery people, you name it. Community service officers for people who have to deal with all the fines that come out of this stuff. In any case, though, the Board of Supervisors has been proposing a new law, or set of laws, that a group called the C4 Committee has been looking into after the last round, when the supervisors were kicked in the butt because the growers, when they saw the proposed law the supervisors had, simply got together enough signatures for a referendum to overturn the law, and the supervisors had to hightail it back. And they presented this latest C4, created a committee that are going to propose a more reasonable law. And it was presented by Sheriff Hart at a community meeting recently, you know, as though it were already a done deal. And in fact, it hasn't been passed by the Board of Supervisors. And I sure as hell hope the Cannabis Alliance advocates, or what, I think it's the CAA, whatever they call themselves, will take an active stance against this law as well. The danger is that it's loaded with a few carrots for some of the big growers, and there may be an impulse to opt out for people with money who are able to back, and some marijuana growers do have some money, obviously. I think it's fair to say, although I haven't got a lot of stats on this, it can be, if not a profitable crop, at least it's a self-supporting crop. And it's one of the reasons that the legalization movement is making headway, not because it's sensible and sane and healthy and fair, but because some large corporate folks can make a lot of money off it. And that, of course, is one of the reasons that the marijuana legalization 4 years ago failed, because a number of the activists who have been fighting for marijuana legalization for years did not want to hand over marijuana to a bunch of corporate assholes who are going to be, you know, branding it, commercializing it, and profiteering from it. You can probably hear my opinion in the tone of my voice. Anyway, I'm going to play an interview I did a couple weeks ago with Nick Balayage, who is on the C4 committee. And I've interviewed him before, but this was, you know, I think it was either right before or right after the supervisors had their meeting. And essentially, they didn't pass. Well, there's a difference of opinion. Some people think that the supervisors followed directly the C4 resolution, the C4 ordinance changes that were proposed. C4 is this group they created. Others think, and Nick is one of those, that it was in fact a complete repudiation of most of the stuff that his group, the Committee of 13, had come up with. And because the supervisors really have their own agenda, some of them want to completely ban marijuana cultivation except in the South County, although they're doing it without saying that. That sounds a little too, you know, opposed to what most people in the county would consider reasonable. So instead, they're imposing all kinds of restrictions, sort of similar to what they do to performers on Pacific Avenue or vendors on Pacific Avenue who are now jewelers. You know, the Vanish the Vendors law has been in force since the 24th. You try and find a jeweler out there. You can find the Feather Lady on the weekends, who has now taken on she calls herself a priestess, and she's a handicraft rather than handicraft displayer rather than a feather vendor. Although displaying anything that is jewelry or handicraftish is still specifically forbidden up and down Pacific Avenue. Anyway, for marijuana, the same kind of the people who created these anti-vendor laws on Pacific Avenue like to claim, well, there's plenty of spaces for people to go, and there are these horrible vendors who are destroying the businesses of the silversmiths and the jewelers. Del Williams Jewelers is going bankrupt, and they're not saying that, but you know, there's all these problems. These people who spend lots of money renting their stores. You know, why can't we? The notion that people on the sidewalk who are selling their jewelry, usually for survival activity, is somehow a threat, an economic threat to those in the stores, is both unlikely for a couple of reasons, both because the street scene, many claim, draw people to Santa Cruz, but also because their businesses are so limited compared to these so-called brick-and-mortar stores that it's ridiculous. But I'm getting lost. Let's turn instead to the cannabis situation and Mr. Balayage has to tell us. If I can get this machine to work, which I'm hoping to do. I'm on the line with Nick Balayage, who's an activist not previously terribly interested in cannabis and marijuana and so forth, as far as I know, but got involved with the Board of Supervisors C4 committee after the board took a couple of chops in the face when an initiative, or I should say a referendum, threw out their last law, or threatened to, and they ran for cover, and I guess one of their covers was the C4 committee.
And you were on that committee of 13, is that correct?
Ben? Lucky number 13, and I was the 13th, I think.
Indeed. Well, 13th could be a lucky number in this case, at least for the public, though perhaps not for the supervisors. I know we talked at least twice about this issue, and it became gloomier and gloomier, or actually more and more laughable. That was the phrase you used when we just started speaking about it now. The proposal that the Board of Supes is coming up with, do you want to summarize it and tell me what you're, what's so funny about that?
Well, it's a very draconian measure. So it's, they come out with these things. People are aware there's a coastal zone. So, for example, if your property is within a coastal zone, which is a certain area from the coast, you fall under the Coastal Commission for various things. So it's harder to build structures in the coastal zone unless you're somebody very wealthy. But out of the blue, the supervisors and staff came out with this new thing where they came out with this a few weeks back or a month back, in which that no outdoor grows would be allowed in the coastal zone plus 1 mile. And that just happens to protect certain supervisors' districts. So it's rather laughable there because all they're doing is de facto prohibitions.
And how big is this area? You say it's a mile from the coastal zone.
So the coastal zone, it varies up and down along the Santa Cruz County coast. But as a quickie rule, you could almost say Highway 1 is a dividing line. Mm. Not exactly, though. So now what they're doing is they're getting coastal zone plus 1 mile. Well, for example, in North County, that puts you past Bonnie Doon.
Hmm.
So that means Bonnie Doon, with a stroke of the pen, is someone cannot do an outside grow. Now, they're doing another hilarious trick. This is in Ryan Coonerty's district, in which they're saying, well, you can do the grow if you have commercial agriculture zoning. Well, nobody is going to grow outdoors along the coast, at least not cannabis, because you have the problems with the moisture. So they're saying, well, you can do it. We're allowing it along the coast in Ryan Coonerty's district if you have commercial agriculture zoning. Well, nobody's going to do it. So then they say that, well, you can do it if you do it in a greenhouse along the coast. Except you can't. They're saying that it has to be existing greenhouses. I don't know if there are any existing greenhouses in Ryan Coonerty's district.
So it looks like Ryan is not a big fan of marijuana growing.
No, but he's talking out of both sides of the mouth. So he's saying one thing, that he's supporting and allowing it, but then he has all these cleverly worded things which are basically create bans.
Now, how much of the county is left beyond the one-mile zone?
Well, it puts pretty much, it leaves, I think, all of District 4, which is South County, which is the district I'm in.
Uh-huh.
So we don't get that, whether you want to call it protection, benefit, or disadvantage, depending upon which side you're looking at, of the coastal zone plus 1 mile. What it does is most of Ryan Coonerty's district is now basically a de facto ban. Zach Friend's district, which is in the Aptos area, he gets a good chunk of his district protected from it. But in addition, he's still pushing to have within the ordinance a cleverly worded little clause which gives a legal definition of his district without saying District 2. So it has in there, it says, no outdoor grows are allowed in the area described in section blank, blank, blank of the county code. And if you were to go look up that definition or that actual section, you see it's the legal boundaries for supervisorial District 2. So his district is will not be allowing outdoor grows unless the supervisors change it. So that means no outdoor grows, period, there.
Now, does this also impact medical marijuana outdoor grows?
If it's personal use, you would still be able to do it, I think.
And how do they define personal use?
Someone that is growing less, that's that 100 square feet, and they're only growing for themselves or a family member, and they have to have a medical card.
And 100 square feet is 10 by 10, so it isn't very big.
Not very big, no. It's like a small bedroom.
And I know we've talked about this before, but what's the current status? How much is actually being grown in this county that you're aware of or that your C4 committee was aware of?
We were never able to get much of an idea, but my guess is there's got to be at least 1,000 growers out there, if not more.
So, I mean, my concern when I talked to you about this before was that if your C4 committee didn't have the stats on how many growers there were and what the actual impact this would be on the growers, and also as far as complaints go, what motivated this entire attempt to essentially prohibit or restrict marijuana grows in terms of real documentation of environmental damage of a systematic kind, not the anecdotal cases,
right,
but, you know, the actual numbers, and also solutions have been undertaken in other areas, if there were such solutions. I'm not aware that your C4 committee did any of that.
Nope.
And so it seems to me, I don't know why it wandered off in the different directions it did. Probably it's all your fault, right, Nick?
It could be. It could be. I think there's a solid case to be made for that.
At least we know. I mean, the number 13 guy is unlucky. I mean, let's...
Well, I know... I'm quite certain that county staff didn't like me being there, so...
Were there others they didn't like being on this committee as well that you think...
No, I really think they didn't like me. I think if they had to reverse, you know, I'm the 13th member that was appointed there, but I would have to say I'm sure I was number one as the one that the county liked the least.
Now, were the staffers present for a lot of the C4 meetings? Or
just a single staffer.
And was this person particularly influential?
I would say the staffers from the county were actually very helpful. I can't say anything bad about them.
Well, you said they didn't like you.
Well, I think I'm talking more of the top floor of the building over there.
Oh, I see. The ones you eventually presented the proposal to, which they ignored.
Well, because I wrote a lot of letters, and I pointed out, I've watched government in action for a long time, as you have, and you know how these, you described committees quite well to me, where they, you're pointed to sit on these things, there's a... they want you to sit and think that you're doing some good, and meanwhile, when things are steered a certain way, or else, whatever it is you come up with, the higher-ups will ignore.
Were things steered a certain way in this committee?
Not to a large degree, and I'm not necessarily sure it was steered. Maybe that was just how people were logically thinking, but I think it was obvious, at least it was to me, and I was trying to, almost from the very beginning, enlighten people that what's going to happen. And what would happen is that once we're done or near done, the supervisors and staff will grab what we did. They'll take the obvious things like, we support protecting the environment, and say, see, you guys came up with a great statement and we agree with you. And then the ones that they don't like, as far as like how much will be allowed to grow or where it'll be allowed to grow.
Let's interrupt you there and say what were the recommendations of the C4 committee as far as how much should be allowed to be grown?
We didn't put a total cap anywhere. The county staff is putting a cap on what would go like in warehouses.
Right, but I mean in terms of if you were to look at more or less the reduction that is happening in the proposed legislation compared with the C4 committee's proposal, how would you describe...
Well, we didn't have this coastal zone plus 1 mile.
And so how much is actually... What's the percentage reduction, you would say, in terms of actual growable area?
Well, when you start doing the coastal zone plus 1 mile, I would guess you must be taking out, you know, I'm going to guess, but if you were to look on a map, it's probably something like a third of all the, maybe a fourth or something like that. People can go to the county website, and they have a GIS map, and you can actually put in some of these parameters.
Well, if you're taking out a fourth, doesn't that leave three-fourths of the county left or to do? I mean, what's your complaint?
Well, then what happens is now they get into zoning. So then when they come along with zoning, you start saying, well, you can only grow on these parcels that have a particular zoning. Unless you have a particular zoning, you're out immediately. You have no chance.
And did the C4 committee have any concerns about the zoning that the board... The supervisor's proposal or the staff proposal to the supervisors is now proposing shrinking?
No, the zoning we kind of agreement with, but what happened happened was is the acreage limits. So the board is going to raise acreage limits in a lot of these areas, a lot of these zoned areas. So rather than maybe before you only needed to have 5 acres, now you're going to have 10, where some places we might have had, I can't remember off the top of my head some of this because it's already been a month or so since we looked at this. But they increased acreage limits and they increased setbacks dramatically. So state law says you have to be 600 feet from a school, period. You can't go below that one from a school. We were suggesting relatively, I wouldn't say smaller, I mean, were there smaller setbacks for things like from a park, from a road, from a library or something like that.
None of which is required by state law.
None of which is required by state.
Mm-hmm.
The board and staff are coming back with a recommendation like 600 feet pretty much from everything.
Well, that's so everybody can be consistent. We have the same thing downtown. They thought, you know, we have to make sure that let's put forbidden zones, and this is what these are, forbidden
right.
to grow zones. This would be in downtown, it's forbidden to sit, forbidden to table, forbidden to perform with a display device. You know, all these things within, now it's almost, I've estimated 98% of the sidewalk is forbidden. You can walk, you can engage in commercial activity, you know, merchants can set up wherever the hell they want, but
right.
the rest of us can't. So it sounds like it's something similar.
Very similar.
But the amount of reduction of the space you said was in terms of because the coastal area and 1 mile plus.
I'm guessing. It might
you're guessing.
Six or something. But now when you start doing, then when you do zoning, then when you do, now the other thing is they're only allowing, so, and this was something C4 was agreement on, is that you're only allowed a percentage of the parcel as far as how much you can grow on. So, for example, if you have commercial agriculture zoning, you could grow no more than 2% of the parcel. So if you had 10 acres of land, that would mean only 2% of that.
And that's, what is the current situation? What percentage can you currently grow on?
They didn't have that before because what happened before is there was a plant limit. So now this is going to be the new thing where it's going to be a percentage.
And how does the plant limit compare in terms of the amount of marijuana you can grow with this proposed limit?
Well, you'd be able to grow a lot more with this limit.
However, you're still upset about it because...
Well, I'm upset because what it does is it forces the growth in certain areas which are very limited. And it's the usual North County elitist type stuff where with the, again, the clever legal wording that sounds reasonable and nice and fair is creating de facto prohibitions in mainly the North County and Mid-County areas.
Plus, it also seems to have favoritism towards large growers and discrimination against smaller ones.
Definitely. I mean, there's one of the things that came out of nowhere from the supervisors or from staff was we pretty much, I thought, had a consensus on C4 in which we thought was when you're having people line up to get a license or register eventually to get a license, because come 2018, the state is going to start issuing licenses. The state will not issue a license unless you get a local license. Hence, local entities have to create a licensing mechanism. Well, it was pretty solid support among C4 that we were to back support the local growers that have been there for a while, been doing it for a while. And the thinking was that anybody that can prove that they've been growing, albeit as technically illegal over the years, that we said we wanted them to be still first in line because they were there doing it. Well, out of the blue, with the magic stroke of the pen, the county added a new little clause in which said that, oh, yeah, someone can prove that they've been growing cannabis for X amount of years, I think it's three years, then, okay, they can register. In addition, anybody that can prove that they've been a farmer with non-cannabis related crops can jump into the fray and be in the list. Now, my sense is the first time I saw that, all that was, I'm guessing, that that's probably some very large corporate type person that's been in negotiations or talks with the county and saying, we'd like to jump into this fray at some point, but we haven't been growing cannabis. Can you put a clause in there to help us out and open the door for us to be able?
Well, are they limiting the number of licenses, period? I mean, why can't everybody line up and just some people will get priority, right?
Well, it all depends on how they want to prioritize it. But remember, because of all of the conditions that they're having and all the restrictions, there are going to be many, many people that aren't even going to get in line because they'll never qualify.
Right. Now, but however, that's independent of this business of allowing the, you know, the people who haven't been there for 3 years to actually get involved. That doesn't really affect, it doesn't discriminate against people who have been there for a long period of time, that particular provision, right? Because
no, but the thing is that we still don't know how they're going to prioritize things and if whether or not they will limit how many licenses.
I see, I got you.
Now, and of course, they're not going to tell the that now, but you can be assured, probably a safe bet, that's an ace up the sleeve that all of a sudden they'll spring up out of nowhere months from now or so.
So are there currently licenses required state and local to grow other vegetables or?
Not that I'm aware of, but I don't know the agricultural industry.
I mean, that's really an important issue because it means that they're making a special case for marijuana, which of course is being done in all kinds of other ways.
Right.
You know, it's a suddenly, whereas, you know, pharmacies don't require huge security guards, and they have much more lethal drugs.
Sure do.
You know, marijuana dispensaries do. Pharmacies are not limited in the way that marijuana dispensaries are. I mean, there's all kinds of bogus, prejudiced restrictions that have nothing to do with real concerns.
I agree with you.
So we're talking with, well, I appreciate if you agree with me. In fact, who wouldn't? I mean, I'm completely reasonable. So have you had any conversations with other members, either the C4 committee or people who are on the CAA, that's the Cannabis Advocates Alliance?
No, I haven't. I talked just in passing with a couple of former members because I attended our supervisor, Greg Campity, held like a neighborhood meeting out at kind of out in the unincorporated area of his district. And some people called me, the supervisor asked me to attend. I showed up a little late, and it was about half, meeting was made up of half concerned residents and half of people in the industry. And I did think it was interesting. One person spoke, and it was a concerned resident.
This was recently?
Yeah, on Thursday night.
Okay.
And one lady spoke, and I can't verify how true the statement was, but she stated that there was a neighborhood meeting held by Supervisor Friend recently to address the issue. And Supervisor Friend allegedly made a claim that Supervisor Caput was trying to put all the marijuana into his own district.
Hoarding the marijuana, eh?
Yeah, which is far from the truth. Supervisor Caput, I can say without a doubt, has been trying to make a fair process so that it's not all just dumped into his district.
Well, I think maybe Supervisor Friend can be urged then to liberalize the requirements in his district so that Caput cannot hoard all the marijuana.
Well put.
Probably won't be happening. Let me ask you, have you talked to Mike Boyd about it? I know he has some lawsuits going around this issue.
I don't know him.
Yeah. The other thing is, and of course this was a big issue that really has sparked the whole thing, the successful referendum signature gathering that prompted the supervisors to back off their law,
Right. Their
previous, not the law that they have now enforced, but the one that they passed last year that was even more restrictive that we've talked about in the past. Is such a response, do you think, likely? I know you haven't talked to people, so perhaps you wouldn't know, but does your, you know, telepathic sense tell you anything? Your clairvoyant sense, perhaps?
If I had to guess, and I haven't talked to them since I have no tie with the industry at all, and I don't know what they're thinking, but it seems to me like everyone is out there to carve a little spot for themselves in the ordinance. And if people were to do a referendum, I think it'd be a sound strategy, but the smart way you would have to do it is you'd have to do a referendum to try to kick what they came out with, and then immediately follow up with your own initiative. Because the problem now is everything's getting into a ticking time clock on when the January 1st, 2018 comes along and the state starts issuing licenses.
Well, that's not too much of a ticking time clock, is it? And we have 2 years before that happens.
Right, but then you would have to do my guess is the way the county would do things is they won't make the ordinance official for some time. They might take some months.
Well, I think there can still be an initiative that overturns the ordinance.
There could, but now you see the problem is if the ordinance is becomes law, you do not use a referendum against it. Now all of a sudden you're going to be running a campaign to do an initiative to change what part of the ordinance, which you'd be coming back to do and say, "Hi everybody, we want to do an initiative in order to change the county code in order to allow grows more in residential areas. Or in order to change the setback so you don't have to be 600 feet from a road, you have to be 100 feet away from the road." All of a sudden then, you might end up losing a lot of sympathetic voters.
So is this is all on your own reflection?
That's my own reflection.
And you haven't shared that with the CAA group?
No.
I don't know.
No, but I think the county has, I believe county staff played this pretty shrewdly, cleverly, deviously, fill in all the other types of adjectives and adverbs you can come up with. And I think county staff had a game plan from day one. I tried to be the voice of warning.
I know. Well, I guess the referendum issue could be done if the county passes something, even if they, you know, set the law date ahead. If they pass the resolution, I don't know. I'd have to look at the law, and I'd be curious to hear what the CAA folks are saying, but apparently not curious enough to get to their meetings. Too bad. Let me get you to sum up because I've got to get this show on the audio so I can get it on the air. And any other thoughts?
Well, I mean, the supervisors are meeting. It's Tuesday, and I think it's at 1:30, the meeting.
Well, usually it starts at 9, but you
this
said
one, this is an afternoon. I think it's already labeled as an afternoon one.
Okay.
The actual item, agenda item.
All right.
And it's just, if you're sympathetic to the industry, my suggestion is you show up and you ask for to get rid of this coastal zone plus 1 mile, to get rid of some of these draconian setbacks, because what it is going to do is it is going to push it into very selected areas. In addition, even if you are against cannabis, this is a warning that I'm telling to people, because I'm coming in it as the outside observer. If you are against cannabis, and then all of a sudden you have these draconian laws that are being passed, you're going to feel good, if you're against it, that you have a piece of paper and a law that says that it can't be grown in this particular area. If it's so draconian, the person that was growing next to you in the past that now cannot get licensed in any way, in all likelihood, that person is going to continue to grow.
Ah, but we have police officers. We have
regulated, unlicensed person growing next to you.
Well, we can send in the cops and make sure that guy serves some time in jail. Prison.
Right. Class. And meanwhile, there's going to be 1,000 of them doing it. And you know how it'll work. It'll be selective enforcement. So the point that I've brought up to some people that I've talked to that are adamantly against cannabis, I told them, I'm not telling you, I'm not pushing it on you, I'm not pushing it away from you, but I'm telling you, be careful. Because what would you rather have next door to you? A person that's growing it, that has a license and is following the rules, or one that doesn't have a license and is not following the rules? And you might not like either, but what happens under, I'm giving you a hypothetical where you only have, you can only pick one of them.
Would you also, Nick, be concerned about the area of that is the minimum required for growing? So they're no longer allowing grows of 5 acres. You have to have 10 acres to grow.
So they'll have having it 5 acres for residential agriculture zoning, I personally think that that's going to get changed by the supervisors. They're going to raise it up even higher at the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
So for commercial agriculture, they're saying 1 acre minimum. And for timber, it's like something like 5 acres. For agriculture zoning, they're saying 10 acres. But again, that's only one part. So you have zoning, acreage, percentage you'd be allowed to grow, and the lethal part is our setbacks. When they start doing 600 feet from a road, 600 feet from a municipal boundary line, 600 feet from a structure, you could have it where you might think you might be trying to grow, you might be a very responsible grower, and you might have a parcel that meets the zoning, and you go in and you think, I'm ready to go, and then they start drawing these 600-foot overlays and say, guess what? Because the 600 feet from this, and this, and this, you can't grow anywhere.
Oh, I'm sure the county will work it all out.
I'm sure they will.
Well, listen, I thank you, Nick, and I don't, well, you never can tell. I may show up at the Stoops meeting just to take a peek. You know,
can you please show up and with a shirt that has some interesting language on it?
Well, I occasionally wear such shirts, but I'm usually on the Tuesdays. It's also the City Hall Freedom Sleepers deal, but you never can tell. If I may get ambitious and climb the stairs to the fifth floor of the county building where this will be happening, 1:30 on Tuesday, the 14th of June.
Bring your little recorder there, you might actually then be able to corner some of these people that haven't been returning your phone calls.
That's a good idea. In fact, if you see Pat Malo, please get his number and let me know what it is.
If you were to show up on Tuesday, you might be able to corner him and others.
It's true. The trouble also is there's simultaneously a shitty council meeting happening that starts around, it starts actually an hour later at 2:30.
That has to be City of Santa Cruz with the language you use.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes, it is. And they are going to be pressing for the final blue box law, or actually where the blue boxes are, how few they are and how small they are, which will allow you to be on Pacific Avenue with a table or be on Pacific Avenue with a sign that says need spare change and a cup. And it will be essentially a very severe restriction. And it's...
You mean like de facto prohibitions again?
Well, we don't want to use that word. Let's just, that would be unconstitutional, you see. Instead, we'll just make it very, very small.
Yes, you could set up here, you can set up in this area as long as it's 300 feet from a bathroom and 400 feet from an ice cream parlor. And
that would work, except there aren't any bathrooms available, at least not at night for people, so that's not a problem.
Right.
All right, well, listen, I appreciate this, Mike. Nick, I got a roll.
Let's do it.
I'll try to get your name right next time.
All right. We got it.
Hey, thanks. We're talking with Nick.
Bolaich.
Thank you, Nick.
All right, Robert. Take care.
Another time. Bye-bye.
Always a pleasure.
All righty.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was a
taped or audioed interview with Nick Bolaich, or Bolaich, depending on how you want to pronounce it. But as fate would have it, I was able to catch poor Nick at home and bushwhack him, and I think he's on the phone right now. Are you there, Nick?
It could be me.
Well, I think it probably is, because I recognize that mocking, jovial tone that you have.
It is me.
Well, hi.
You've got me cornered. Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
I'm good. I spent so much time blathering for the first half hour that I'm kind of rushing myself along, but I thought you packed a lot of information into that.
You look like a Russian.
Yes. You packed a lot of information into that interview that we just had that, well, you didn't hear because I caught you late, but you talked a lot about different things like the procedures of the supervisors in limiting a lot of the North County by the 1 mile setback from the coastal zone, increasing all kinds of other setbacks, also increasing the minimum acreage requirement for growth. I'm probably only going through a few of them, but I mean, it was really an information-packed interview, and I think it was good. But I wanted to know if there's been, you know, anything since then that has come to your attention, any reflections you've had. I know you made it to the supervisor's meeting. I guess you'd spoken to us right before you got there, a day or two before.
Yes.
Do you want to give us any thoughts you have or anything? And give us any kind of alerts as to what's coming up or new insights you have.
Well, just day before yesterday, there was another agenda item on there for the supervisors in which they were dealing with dispensaries. So now they are at the stage of crafting the rules for dispensaries. So that was the latest thing. The cultivation thing is getting more and more fine-tuned. So it looks like a lot of those setbacks are going to be in place. The interesting thing that happened at the supervisor meeting a few weeks back regarding the cultivation was that Supervisor Caput, I think, kind of surprised some people, and he came out and said that he wanted the same rules for his district that are in Supervisor Zach Friend's district. So Supervisor Zach Friend has had for some time where the outdoor grows are not allowed. And his is just this one gated community district that doesn't allow outdoor grows because that's what he wants.
Wasn't this a main bone of contention last summer when the CAA, Cannabis Advocates Alliance, successfully pushed for a referendum and forced the supervisors to pull in their horns?
Well, I wasn't involved back then, but for the referendum, that was really overturning a bigger thing that the supervisors were doing as far as they were basically shutting down, for the most part, all the grows, kind of like that. But
so this is a proposed shutdown in French's and in Caput's district.
Well, so Friend has, in his district, for some time, he's had, this is now going on for several years, the county crafted some laws some years, several years back, in which they kind of were allowing grows, and they had this 99 plant limit. But from day one, Supervisor Friend was asking, so this is this Aptos Corlitas area, asked for and got support from the other supervisors, which he had an outdoor ban in his district and his district only. So Supervisor Caput, when he first asked me to sit on that C4 committee, one of the things he was wanted for me to do, and which I wanted to do, was to try to have something that was fair and try to keep things balanced. I was against, from day one, this one district having an outdoor ban because it's just, all it is like a gated community.
Now, was Friend's only district, or I should say, is it the only district right now? Because the current laws, are the ones that were passed 3 or 4 years ago. Is it the only district with a ban, an outdoor ban?
His is the only one.
And how much of the county does his district take up?
Well, you're looking at, population-wise, it comes out being one-fifth. Land size, I'm guessing it would probably be more than one-fifth because he has a lot of that Aptos Corlitas area where you're having that area that's probably going up. You get Santa Cruz Mountains up there to the summit.
I guess more pertinent is how much of the area is marijuana growable compared to the other areas.
Oh, I think in his district probably quite a bit because you're getting into that high and dry territory.
And has there been a lot of enforcement in that district against people who have essentially rebelled and refused and continued to grow?
I don't know, because I know that newspaper known as the Santa Cruz Sentinel, they had an article in the paper today. It was on page 2, and it had to do with, looks like the sheriffs did some pretty big bust of large growers, but I don't know, they mentioned I think it was Ormsby and Highland, which I don't know those areas well, but I know that's up there. I'm not sure if that's in Supervisor District or Supervisor Leopold's district. Supervisor Friend or Supervisor District, I'm sorry. Supervisor Friend or Supervisor Leopold's district.
Now, have the other supervisors haven't pushed, the other three supervisors haven't pushed to have outdoor grows banned in their districts, and if not, why not?
Well, I don't. They have not, and
that last meeting was the first time that Supervisor Caput did it. And I'm going by what he said at the meeting, but I think what he was always been afraid of is that the North County politics was going to craft these cleverly worded ordinances, which have things that sound reasonable with all these rules and regs, but when you put it to a nutshell, what you find out is that it's pushing everything into South County. And I think Supervisor Caput kind of pulled a pretty smart move on his part, in which that he's saying, well, if Supervisor Friend wants an outdoor ban, so do I. And one of the key points that he brought up was if you go out, I think it's around Monta Vista Christian School, I think it's the high school out there, which is around Wheelock Road area in South County. There's sort of a dividing line. I think it might actually be on Wheelock Road. So one side of the road is in Supervisor Friend's district, and the other side of the road is in Supervisor Caput's district. So one of the things that Supervisor Caput expressed is how can you have it where just across the street you have houses which you have the same zoning, you have basically everything the same except they're in different supervisorial districts.
Well, is this a gambit, Nick, to force Friend to back down, or is it really an attempt to ban outdoor growing? And what's the significance of this? If you are banned outdoor growing, doesn't that largely eliminate commercial marijuana growing?
Well, it would two things. I think one of two things would happen is someone could come along and say, well, they'll just go into the other districts. I don't think that's realistic. I think all that happen is you'll have a whole bunch of people that will just continue to illegally grow in up there in the mountains because it's back to the high and dry mentality or belief. The other thing is that you could have it where, which might be the county's goal, is to try to just force it more into indoor, which would then be either greenhouses or warehouses, which would be very limited. There are a lot of greenhouses in South County. Lots of greenhouses.
Now, is it much more expensive to do that? And B, you mentioned in your previous audio interview that there was going to be a ban on new greenhouses proposed.
Well, that's the clever stunt that was done at the last supervisor meeting, that one from a few weeks back, in which there was that coastal zone plus 1 mile buffer. So for the listeners, what the supervisors, or at least a couple of supervisors, were proposing, and it looks like they're getting some support so far, is that they were going to disallow outdoor grows in the coastal zone boundary plus an additional mile, unless it's on commercial agriculture zoning or else possibly agriculture zoning. Well, the it sounds good and you think, okay, that makes sense, but the commercial agriculture zoning in the coastal zone, from my understanding, no growers want to grow outdoor in such an area because of the moisture.
And there are large zones in those areas that are not commercial agriculture where they would want to grow.
I don't think they would. Well, I think they would, because what happens is if you do the coastal zone plus 1 mile, that wipes out Bonnie Doon territory.
Right, you were saying that, but I'm saying that they're trying to put in this sort of proviso, oh, well, you can grow in the commercial agricultural zone. What I'm saying is that are there other zones in the area that they do want to grow in that would be excluded?
Well, what would happen is, well, first of all, let me kind of finish the statement on it, what the supervisors came up with, or at least a couple of them, is this coastal zone plus 1 mile. So it's a trick because it says, you could grow in the coastal zone plus 1 mile if you're on commercial agriculture zoning. Well, the commercial agriculture zoning, and this is talking outdoors, commercial agriculture zoning that's along the coast, from my understanding, none of the growers want to do it because they'll run into so many problems with the moisture from the fog and stuff like that. So it's a phony baloney offer to say that, oh, you can grow on the commercial agriculture zoning along the coast outdoor because nobody is going to do it.
Yeah, no, I understand that, Nick, and the reason I interrupt.
So then the other thing that they had with it was is that they said you could do it in the greenhouses.
Right.
But you couldn't build any new greenhouses.
And I ask you, is that also the case being proposed in the South County, no new greenhouses?
It would be, because they would be in the coastal zone. So only the ones alongside the coastal zone plus the 1 mile. Well, here's the thing that where it just exposes this fraud. From my understanding, there's a little to maybe none of existing greenhouses in North County coast. And then if you make it so that you can't build any new ones, well, all you've done is created a disguised de facto prohibition. Most of those existing greenhouses are in South County, and pretty much all of those are going to be in Supervisor's Friend's district, because Supervisor Caput's district doesn't have any of the coast.
So I guess, again, I'm trying to get to this question because we've gone over what you said before, and it's interesting to hear. But how much of the two districts is a marijuana suitable for growing? I mean, we pointed out that, you know, is it relevant that it's not being allowed in the coastal zone because that's a bad place to grow? You say too much moisture. Is that my understanding? Or is it a good place to grow the coastal zone plus 1 mile? Are those...
The tricky part is, what you're saying is correct, is nobody wants to grow outdoor really along the coast. The trick that the supervisors are doing, for whatever reason, maybe it's to appease the Bonnie Doon people, is adding the 1 mile. So you take your coastal zone boundary, and now you're adding 1 mile to it, and conveniently it goes in there to Bonnie Doon, which is now up in the hills where you have people growing.
So the 1 mile extension zone is a suitable area for growing?
Definitely.
Okay, that was my question.
Definitely.
So we're talking
Sorry,
about...
I took a long way to answer.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I tried to interrupt you, but I didn't try hard enough, obviously.
Yeah.
So have you talked to any CAA, Cannabis Alliance, advocates, people?
No, I actually don't know anything about that group. So. If I've talked to some of them, I don't know if they're part of it.
I mean, I know, as I said, I wandered into, I didn't tell you this, but I think I was mentioning on the air, a meeting with Sheriff Hart that about 100 people, many of them growers, I imagine, up in the Felton area, went to. And they were primarily getting told by the sheriff about the new law, which hasn't passed, but that what they will be expected to do and so forth, and how reasonable it was and blah, blah, blah. And it was more like he wasn't trying to persuade them about it. He was trying to sort of make them assume it had already passed, and he was going to facilitate their obeying it. And
okay.
The question I asked him publicly, and then afterward following up privately with him, was really having to do with a question I was asking you several months ago, which is about the number of busts that are going on with his deputies in the last year. I wanted to, so can you please provide us with a list of the arrests and the number of confiscations, where the confiscations happened, and also the number of complaints that actually provoked these busts.
Uh-huh.
And I made this request publicly, and he said he would do it. I don't think he will. And then I talked to him privately and again asked him to do it. He gave me his card, said he would. But since that period of time, which was a couple of weeks back, he hasn't responded to me, and so I put in a Public Records Act request specifically asking for that information or any records referencing that information. So we'll see if that goes anywhere. It might or might not. Anything new happened otherwise? Otherwise, I'm going to roll along.
Other than they're proceeding with the dispensaries.
And what are they doing with the dispensaries?
So what they're doing is they're doing a level one stage in which they're only going to allow I guess you could say legal current dispensaries to submit an application to get a level one dispensary license. So in addition to that, they're crafting further rules.
What are the current laws regarding dispensaries?
You know, I don't even know the details of those. I read the recent ordinance, the one that was being proposed. And again, it has to do with setbacks, these background checks, doing the live scan, having employees a certain age, can't do this, can't have that, things like that, which I think for the most part are probably already rules in place. So it's going to be back to zoning again, back to setbacks, and then a lot of rules as far as what you can and can't.
Well, I know that city ordinance has destroyed the marijuana dispensaries in Santa Cruz and actually resulted in no dispensaries between the period of 2000 and 2005. And then Lisa Milano's Greenway opened for a while. And I guess Ken Sampson's Club also opened for a while. And then Sampson's Club closed, or actually both of them closed. But I think they got a couple of clubs. They're only allowing two in the entire city of Santa Cruz.
Wow.
And so you have all these other clubs opening up in the county. I'm just wondering, does this...
There are 13 in the county.
Maybe that's not so many.
Unincorporated county.
Is there... how many of these do you know are going to be affected by this new law? Will they be shut down? Will they be allowed? Do you know?
I tend to think that a lot of them will probably be okay. What some people, myself included, there was a... It wasn't organized. It just kind of turned out that way. There was an effort to try to add the Santa Cruz Veterans Alliance to the list. So Santa Cruz Veterans Alliance gives a lot of cannabis free to veterans. And the thinking there was to try to add them to the list. The supervisors did not do it, but they seemed like they might be open to at some point maybe adding them to the list. So what will happen is when the state law kicks in January of 2018, it looks like the way the law is worded that unless you have a dispensary, you cannot give it away for free, it being the cannabis.
That's weird. So, I mean, even for personal use?
Well, personal use you can't. So personal use, you're supposed to just use it for yourself.
What about your father or your brother?
Well, I think maybe in the family you could do something, but I think something where someone is giving it away to people and they're a licensed cultivator, they wouldn't be able to do it without having a dispensary.
So no free marijuana for poor folks is what you're saying.
Right, or else what you would have to do is you would have to then, because the state law is going to be something else. You're going to have a license to be a cultivator, you'll have to be a license to be a distributor, then you'll have a person that will be a tester, and then you'll have someone who will be a transporter, and then you'll have a dispensary. So if you were a cultivator and wanted to give some of your stuff away and you did not have a dispensary, my understanding of the way it would be is that you would have to pay the tester. Then you would have to pay your distributor, then you have to pay the transporter to take it to the dispensary in order to have them give it away. And they're not going to want to give it away, so I guess the person that would want to, the cultivator that originally would want to give it away, would have to pay every step of the way to ultimately give it away.
Well, this just sounds like a, it sounds like a lot of shit to me, I must say.
I would have to agree with you. But, I mean, I think the bigger thing that I would, it's interesting the conversation that you said, the comments that the Sheriff Hart was making.
Yeah.
I'm an outsider on this thing because I'm not involved in this industry. But I've been involved in politics long enough, and so have you. And I think a lot of times you could read between the lines of what's coming. And my guess is what's coming is the hints are being dropped by the government. Is that the wild free days are going to end. And once these licenses start kicking in, and once these laws kicking in, the tolerance for the allowing the people that aren't following the rules is going to go out the window.
I don't know how much tolerance we have given the kind of stories that are appearing in the paper today that you mentioned, but let's leave it there. Nick, I take it you probably don't want to be called by the many listeners who are eager to hear more from what you have to say. But if anybody is interested in more information from Nick, give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, 423-4833 with your question. I will pass it on to Nick, unless you feel like giving out your number, of course.
No, I'll let you pass it on to Nick.
I will filter the calls. So when, you know, when Supervisor French calls, what the hell is his name? Zach Friend. When he calls, he's just going to have to wait, okay?
He'll just have to wait.
Hey, thank you, Nick.
All right, Robert. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, me too. Bye-bye.
You take care.
And that is, I guess, the first of our look into the marijuana mess being stirred up at the supervisors, allegedly to deal with the state licensing law. There's going to be having an interview. I think probably we'll be playing it on Sunday from Mike Boyd, who is taking a more radical approach. We've talked to him before. He actually is suing the county, the city, various other individuals, the sheriff. I probably have some of this wrong, and I apologize if Mike's listening. In order to point out that all the attempts to tax marijuana through any of these licensing schemes and so forth violate Proposition 215 passed by the voters in 1996. I frankly don't think he's going to get anywhere with this stuff, but I'd love to be wrong, and we'll be hearing from him then. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. That conversation will probably happen Sunday morning in early July, which is coming right around the corner, along with the July 4th, triple fine zones, 48 hours before and 48 hours after July 4th. Throughout the city for minor infractions, you get to pay through the nose anyway, but now you really get to pay through the nose. You get to pay through the nose, the bowels, the mouth, the ears, you name it. And I guess the main target is fireworks, as though that were the major threat in Santa Cruz. I'm not aware that there have been any significant fires started by fireworks in Santa Cruz in the last two decades, but again, I haven't been researching it. Maybe I'm missing them. I have heard a lot of resentment about the Gestapo squads. It's not really Gestapo, it's quite kind of the wrong word. Not that we're not talking about armed gunmen who are acting in a thuggish fashion. I think Gestapo is a bit more plainclothes-ish, and I don't think these guys on the 4th of July and the days before and after are going to be in plainclothes. Let's get musical, and I'll be back. We'll turn to something other than marijuana, and maybe your phone calls, 427-3772. 427-3772 is the call-in number if you'd like to call here.
In this factory, now the boss man says, hey, you're not what we need. The penguins in the suits, they know nothing but greed. It's a solitary life for your mouths to feed. But who cares about us? Take me down to where the worlds collide, and leave me here till I'm satisfied. So let the revolution begin. Now I track these bones across the barren land. The once a city, now an outstretched hand. We can't lose our sense of on our backseat refugee. So take me down to where the world collides, and leave me here till I'm satisfied. There'll come a day when all of us will show we won't be afraid. Although we're crashing, we won't burn. There's a revolution. We'll be right back.
And that was Floggin' Molly from Outer Rim Productions. I'm not quite sure who else was involved, but that had a beat and it had some punch. So, a couple of quick news updates. This weekend, Andrea Morgan called me on the phone in tears. She was in lockup and being denied methadone. In fact, she asked that I, or perhaps gave me permission is a better way of putting it, although I think she was, I think she'd still be up for it. She wanted to okay my playing this on free radio. Now, I've already played a long interview that I had with, actually it was a long phone conversation, I believe, live phone conversation, with John Colby, who has been tirelessly advocating for her. And actually, the Colbys have been able, I think, through their pressure, to get her bail reduced and get her out of jail. She called me 2 or 3 days ago to confirm she was out. It's not too clear whether she has a court date or not. She was in jail on $2,500 bail after being picked up on the median for having a panhandling sign. It's illegal to do that. That's an infraction. It doesn't normally involve jail. But the reason they jailed her, supposedly, well, it wasn't really clear, but one of the pretexts that they can use to jail someone for an infraction is the prospect that they're going to continue the crime. And Andre has been ticketed many times in the past, or at least a number of times, for being on the median, often at ocean and water streets, with a sign, you know, need help, looking for donations. And apparently she gets them at times. And that is illegal now. As I've mentioned before, it's illegal to be there with a protest sign. It's illegal to be there standing and chatting with someone. If you're crossing the street, it's not illegal, as long as you don't linger on the median. And there was the pretext were that I think it distracts the drivers. This, again, was one of those anecdotal uses. It's actually a cover story for the bigotry of neighborhoods that want to get rid of panhandlers in their area, kind of the Take Back Santa Cruz vigilante-style squads. Anyway, let's hear Andrea from jail. This is another issue that we talked about on the previous show, which has to do with the Santa Cruz County Jail, that Sheriff Hart, Jim Hart's jail, its refusal to provide methadone. And actually, John Colby has done a lot more on this and written a formal complaint to everybody in the world, but specifically the Department of Justice, I believe, or some other agencies that hopefully will put pressure using his theory of the big gorilla. It's kind of guerrilla warfare, letting the big gorilla go after the little gorilla as a sort of a way of dealing with a little gorilla that's on your case, because both of them are gorillas, of course, and not really ultimately to be trusted, and at least that's my perspective. And so we know that someone died of pneumonia. A number of people have died because of this private medicalized system, which partially the reason for that may be they don't want to send someone to emergency rooms, as they didn't want to send Krista DeLuca last year to the emergency room when she was choking on her own vomit, when she was overdosing on heroin. And indeed, I spoke with another woman who was overdosing on heroin at the Freedom Sleepers. She'd just gotten out of jail and had come to talk to me about it. Unfortunately, my machine ran out of steam, and I'm going to have to catch her later. And I hope I do. I think she's very articulate and has a lot to say, as well as some eye-opening accounts of what's going on in the county jail and how wretched things are there. Santa Cruz has a very high death rate for the so-called medical conditions. Anyway, let's hear Andrea so you can get a sense of at least what it was like for her when she called me. I think it was Friday night. With Andrea from jail, who was arrested apparently after, I guess there was an earlier incident with office. Sorry, technical problem, but we're not going away. Don't you go away either. With Andrea from jail, who was arrested apparently after, I guess there was an earlier incident with Officer Hoppy, SCPD, because you've been on the median holding up a sign seeking help.
Yeah.
And so what happened that time?
Well, on May 14th, I wasn't even actually panhandling. I was standing on the medium, and I was waiting for the light to change so I could get the rest of the way across the street. And Hoppy had just came up on the medium, and he said hi to me. He said, how are you doing? I said, cool. And then when the light turned green, I proceeded to continue across the street. And he came, and he grabbed me. He goes, hey, I'm not done with you yet. And he grabbed me, and he dragged me over to the corner, and it was all bad. And, you know, threw me down and tossed my walker and everything. And that was on May 14th. But today, earlier, I just got snatched off the medium a couple hours ago, and the sheriff said they had some crazy changes. That I might have to stay a couple of days, and I go to the methadone clinic every day to get my dose, and I can't stay here a couple of days. I don't belong here, Robert.
I hear you, babe. So what did he say he was taking you to jail for?
They didn't really say, but it's fine. I don't know, really. I don't know. I'm just upset, though.
Yeah, I understand, babe. So, yeah, I mean, I don't even know what your what's your full name?
Megan Andrea Morgan.
And what's your date of birth?
9/23/66.
And you don't know what it is you're being charged with, huh?
I don't know. No, I don't know. Can you find it?
Well, you should be able to find out by asking the clowns at the jail. How long have you been held there for?
Finally, to half an hour so far. They put me in this little room. The last time they let me stay, sit out in the main area, but they put me in this one little room here. And I don't know why. I mean, I didn't do anything deserve to get put in here. I'm not combative or anything.
And what? When were you last held in jail?
May 14th, I got brought here. It's about 8 o'clock at night, but they let me out about 2 in the morning.
Did they charge you with something at that time? Did you have to go to court?
Well, I went to court on June 21st this last week, and then the girl on the second floor of the DA's office said there's something about they're still reviewing my case to just keep checking back.
So do you know what you're charged with?
Not exactly, no.
What were you charged with in the earlier case?
I don't know exactly. I'm not sure what it said on the paper, but... Oh, no.
I gotcha. Well, shit. I don't know what to tell you, Andrea, except... how long have they held you for?
I've been here, like, probably almost an hour, 45 minutes or so.
And where did they pick you up?
Huh?
Where were you arrested?
In SoCal and Ocean, right there.
Anybody witness it?
People and cars that saw that's about it.
Right, I got you. No one who was standing by?
No.
I got you. And did you have a sign with you?
Yeah, but I didn't have it up or anything.
What did the sign say?
It was just pictures of, like, food and stuff.
Huh. So, how many days have you been doing this?
Pretty much almost half do it every day, you know.
For how many?
How many out there?
What's that?
I miss a lot of days. Actually, I missed a lot of days this last week.
And how many hours a day do you do it?
It depends. Sometimes just a few.
And how does it work for you? Do you get any response?
Yeah, I get people to help me. But I don't understand with this crap that they added some crazy charge. How can they add a crazy charge, Robert?
Oh, they've done that on a number of occasions with people. They're the police department, you know. They have a lot of power.
Yeah.
Often those charges are dropped. Sometimes they want you to plead to one charge, so they stack up a bunch of charges against you.
Yeah.
Well, it's the weekend. That's another problem. So if they choose to hold you, they could be holding you until Monday or Tuesday. You know that.
I know, and I'll be sick if I don't get my methadone.
Have you asked for it?
Huh?
Have you asked? You should tell the jail you want to talk to the nurse and that you need your methadone.
I don't know what's going to happen, They know about that. They know I go to the methadone clinic.
The people who arrested you specifically know that?
Well, I told the sheriff out here. They know.
Well, then ask to see a nurse. They may deny you, but you have document the fact that you're trying to see a nurse. I mean, if you're going to have to get sick, you should be able to get something back for it. You should show that show that you're trying to get help. Do you have the number of your doctor?
I don't have a doctor right now. A steady doctor.
I see. Do you have a social worker or anybody who's covering your case?
Not really. I just have a counselor. I talked to you at the methadone clinic.
Do you know someone at the methadone clinic?
Yeah, I have a counselor there at the methadone clinic.
Do you have his number?
No.
She's
not there on the weekend.
And she hasn't given you her home phone number?
No.
Boy, difficult situation, Andrea.
Yeah, it's not my fault that I'm in this position. That's what sucks so bad about it. It's really not my fault,
Of course you're innocent. I mean, assuming what you told me to be true, you certainly are innocent. So that's not the issue. It's just a difficult situation for you, that's all,
God damn, I can't believe this.
I hear you, babe. And you're alone in a cell?
Yeah.
And can you see any other cells from where you are?
No, not really. It's always
and
left of me and the door is open. There's nobody in it.
Have they told you how long they're going to keep you?
Nobody said that. The sheriff said he thinks they have some crazy charge and it might be a couple days.
And you told him at that time that you need methadone.
No, I said I can't stay here a couple days. I got to go to the methadone clinic in the morning.
And what was the name of the sheriff you talked to? Well, the next time you talk to a sheriff, make sure you get her his name, by the way.
Uh-huh.
Not that it matters a hell of a lot to how you're feeling right now, but it would be good for you to know that.
Why did you say that to scare me?
Possibly.
Saying that, I think they have some crazy charge, it could be a couple days. What if you could say that to scare me,
Possibly. I'll give a call to the jail and see what your charge is if they have it. That's not going to help much because, unless you can find somebody who wants to put up money to bail you out, and I don't even know if it's bail or no bail. And bail is something you don't get back,
Right.
Unless you're found not guilty in a trial.
Yeah.
So, That's pretty much it. That's all I can do at this end, Andrea. I can call Steve Plaich, talk to him. You know him, right?
Yeah.
I don't know how much help he's going to be, but I could try.
Yeah.
And I can also play this on the air tomorrow morning if you want.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you need to, call me again. But the problem is there's not much that I can do, or that I will do, at least in this situation, other than what I've told you. So let me, I will, however, pass on to people that you are in jail, that you are looking for help. There's one more call I can think I might give a call to. I know a guy in Monterey who runs a methadone clinic in Salinas, and he's very upset because in the jail, Christine DeLuca died of pneumonia, because of heroin withdrawal, and because they didn't take care of it.
Oh, my God.
But, that isn't the usual thing that happens to people, as I understand it, who have to withdraw and don't get methadone treated in jail.
So it's, you know, it's just, of course, obviously, I would imagine it's very uncomfortable, that's all.
Well, you can dehydrate to death because you get diarrhea and you can't retain fluids. You get such bad diarrhea and you just can't retain fluids. So it can get really bad. You know, you can die from, like, dehydration, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let me see, make a few calls just to let a few people know where you are. Not that that's going to do anything, but I will try to do that.
Uh-huh.
And if you need to get back to me, give me another call.
Okay. Okay, I'll call you back in a little bit.
If you wish. Again,
okay.
You know, I don't know what I can do, but hang in there, Andrea.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Robert.
No problem, babe. Bye-bye.
And that was a phone call on Friday night. Actually, I think it might have been Saturday night, one of the two. I was able to get a hold of the Colbys, but not anyone else. Didn't get a call back from Steve Plaich. I think I called him. I did contact Doug Loisel, the head of the methadone clinic in Salinas, who's been on our show, and he called me back the next day. I didn't play this on Sunday because I got wrapped up in the lengthy discussion with John Colby, who spent a lot of time, hour after hour, on the phone contacting the sheriff, contacting the health section of the jail, or trying to contact them, and so on, without any real success, in this, except in the sense that I believe Andrea went to court on Tuesday morning. Her $2,500 bail she was released OR on her own recognizance without bail, and I don't know that she has a court date. I suspect she does. I didn't get a clear message from her on that. What I may do is I may call her up to get her analysis of this. The issue of how people in jail who need methadone are being treated in Santa Cruz, I think, is a very real and important one. We've seen these recent deaths, and of course, more important, the issue of how this private medical group, the California Forensic Medical Group, which is running the services, a for-profit group, and apparently they don't want to kick in the amount of money to take her to take. At least they didn't want to for Krista DeLuca to take her to the emergency room when she kept begging for that to happen last year and then died in jail. Now there's a lawsuit against that jail, and I hope they successfully sue their asses off. And after some of staying up all night and doing a lot more work, John Colby sent the following letter to all kinds of city officials, city, state, federal. Since Saturday night, I have been running on caffeine and adrenaline, advocating with the Santa Cruz County Jail Sheriffs, the jail medical staff, from their contractor, the California Forensic Medical Group, CFMG, and various other local law enforcement agencies to protect my client, Megan Andrea Morgan. He actually knew Andrea and had her a client in the past. He helps people who are disabled, John does, from dying because she is a recovering opiate addict who is prescribed methadone, which the medical staff in the jail do not provide, as well as not providing medical care to mitigate the effects of opiate withdrawal. To understand the seriousness of this, one only need to read the recent Santa Cruz Sentinel articles by Stephen Baxter about the tragic and unnecessary death of 23-year-old Krista DeLuca in the Santa Cruz County Jail under somewhat similar circumstances. And he then gives the citations of those articles, interesting articles by Baxter, which I think I may have read in part in prior shows. Unknown to the jail, the sheriffs, and the federal government, I've been gathering evidence from witnesses and other sources about crimes occurring at this facility. The depth of depravity and criminal indifference to human life by the sheriffs and medical staff running this jail is so unbelievable that I have put off asking for investigations by the California Department of Justice, U.S. Department of Justice, FBI, Department of Health and Human Services of Inspector General, and the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights, because I am a disabled single person fighting so much oppression already that I put up advocating against this jail, the CFMG, that's the private medical group, and the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office until I thought I could devote the necessary time and resources to it. However, By placing my premier disabled homeless client in mortal danger, these agencies and contractors forced my hand. Bluntly, I don't allow anyone to endanger my people. I will risk my life to protect the lives of my clients. Loving the oppressed and hating oppression demands this kind of commitment. To understand this, watch the video of Dr. Cornel West, I'm on fire for justice, and it gives a link. To understand how some of the despicable crimes and civil rights abuses which came to my attention reference these links, and it gives some more links from newspaper articles. I realized when I was awake early Monday morning to contact senior officials at the jail and Santa Cruz County Sheriff Coroner Jim Hart that I hadn't received an email from him for over 3 days. I remembered how former Santa Cruz Homeless Services Center employee Stephen Nelson inexplicably disappeared after the drastic budget cuts the Homeless Services Center, which I call the Homeless Lack of Services Center, experienced due to 5 grant denials from the California Department of Housing and Community Development Department, HCD, due to the poor performance and terrible grant applications by the Homeless Lack of Services Center. Also, the Homeless Lack of Services Center, that's my wording, he calls it the Homeless Services Center, lost an undisclosed sum on money to the settlement of a racial discrimination lawsuit brought against them by Jeremy Miller and Dwayne Whitley. Santa Cruz County Superior Court Judge Paul Maragonda sealed this, so no one knows how much money was lost due to racial discrimination by the HSC. I believe it was $100,000. That's what I was told by Jeremy Miller before his attorney, Jonathan Gettleman, shut him up. Former Santa Cruz Mayor Don Lane knew about this settlement, yet failed to inform his colleagues on the city council and the city staff while he advocated for diverting city funds to plug the shortfall. I informed the Santa Cruz County Board of Supervisors and County Council Dana McCray about this while they also diverted money to the Homeless Lack of Services Center to plug their leaking budget, but not enough money to restore meals, I might add to John Colby's letter. And I think this letter, one of the problems I think that John has is he tends to wander from the points that, the real point, which is discrimination in the jail. But his wandering I find relevant, certainly, to a lot of the issues I raise, and hence I think it's useful to read this letter. The Department of Justice promised me they would investigate this. It's a smoking gun fraud on a huge scale. Homeless Lack of Services staff and local government officials should go to prison for this. Don't know if I agree there, but I certainly think they should be held accountable. Anyway, Stephen left the HSC, that's the employee, and became very vocal. I guess he was an employee. He was a client. And became very vocal in the homeless activist community about HSC, Homeless Lack of Services Center, fraud and crime. Soon after, Stephen disappeared without explanation, never to reappear. Many local homeless activists suspect foul play. Some believe the SAPD, the police department, are the culprits. After exposing the depth of local corruption, anything is believable to me. Thinking about Stephen's unexpected disappearance and your recent silence, that's talking about the sheriff, I made 4 calls to the FBI to describe your precarious position as a disabled homeless whistleblower living at the HSC under their thumb who exposed your allegations to the very people you claim are the conspirators behind the crime, fraud, public corruption, and racketeering under the RICO Act, which we are both working on investigating. The FBI advised me to call 911 for action by the SCPD. This disturbed me because the SCB may be complicit in Stephen's disappearance, and my own experiences show the SCPD is completely corrupt. I can expand upon that allegation. Seeing no choice, I called Santa Cruz Regional 911 to dispatch an SCPD officer for a health and welfare check. SCPD officer Ryan Kiar was dispatched. This troubled me, too, because he has a history of excessive force documented on Santa Cruz Indie Bay, and women have complained of inappropriate sexual conduct by him. And he goes on to talk about, he's also referring to the case of Andy Carcello, who is a client at the Pauley Loft at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, whose emails I've read. He's concerned about what he describes as wretched, unsanitary conditions, disrespectful treatment of clients, trying to warehouse people in Watsonville rather than assist them in getting into Santa Cruz housing or respect their needs to remain there until such time as they can find that housing. Anyway, it's There's more to this letter, but as I said, John, in my view, tends to ramble isn't quite the word. He draws in lots of material that I think is extraneous and exhausts the reader and the listener, and that's a problem. But his work, his attempt to get to the bottom of these issues, his attempt to represent people that he cares about, particularly disabled people, he and Pat Colby both, is commendable. And I salute them for that. We have about 6 minutes left in the show with all the flood of phone calls that's come in. I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to criticize at this time, but I'm keeping an ear on all you people and hearing the silence out there. Let's play a few street interviews before Uncle Dennis comes lurching into the studio to do his show From the Cream to the Dregs, which happens at 8 o'clock. Let's see where we'll begin this from. How about here?
So I'm talking with
Gary Maxvenge.
And Gary, you have gloomy news to report.
Rash of mountain bike fever in town.
And that's happened to you?
15 days ago, yeah.
What did you lose?
24 speed track.
What color was it? Any identifying?
Blue. It was licensed, but never found yet.
So you're on foot now.
Yeah, I lost it. They robbed me behind Front Street.
If I hear anything, you hear anything, listeners, give a call to 423-4833, and I don't know how I'm going to contact you, but
I have a Front Street.
You saw me twice today. I mean,
yeah.
Anything else happening you want to point out?
I hope I get it back.
You want to say anything? Thanks, Gary.
I don't think so.
That doesn't sound too good. I apologize also for any crunching you may have heard as I eat a wretched dinner here, or a pseudo-dinner. There's a long show coming up on Sunday, and that's going to be at 9:30 as usual. We're going to be following further the marijuana situation, lots of street interviews. I'm not quite sure what longer interviews from some folks I'm still kind of more on the M.H. Can situation, perhaps. That's mental health peer group, which has been under a lot of pressure and has in turn been put some pressure on its clients. And I may have more for you on that, for all you listeners who are interested in that subject. If you have stuff you want to bring to my attention, it's at 423-4833. That's the off-air number, 423-4833. Or you can always call the studio while I'm actually broadcasting, 427-3772. We're going to go out on a little music here, give Dennis a little time to set up, give me a time to break down, and I guess I'll get back to you on Sunday. Hope you come back.
I'll dedicate it to all the nice folks in NATO. To the Battle of New Orleans.